Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. All the better because we have a live audience tonight.
We have a live audience. Now, usually when we've done live shows in the past, this is the point in which the audience would applaud to make themselves known to the people at home. But we're doing this on Zoom for the first time. So people on the Zoom call are now all cheering frantically in their little video image, which is great. But we're gonna do this as a live show, and we're gonna take questions, which I think is gonna drive most of our conversation. Thing. Yes, we are being hosted this evening by the Edinburgh History Society, which has hosted us our live shows before, at least on one occasion.
That's right.
And they are, and we have praised them on the show before because they do really amazing work, both in the academic sphere and other parts of student life. So
that's right. Wonderful hosts, and there are students, and we're thrilled to be here.
That we are. All right. So we're less than a week from the election, Frank, which I think is sort of dominated the news. And you know, people are talking about this election as being the most important election of a generation. You hear that a lot. Donald Trump has said this is the most important election in American history. How in your mind does this election stack up?
I didn't realize there was an election in only a week. That's amazing.
Oh, you.
I mean, if there's one thing Donald Trump and Joe Biden agree on, it's that the election is very important and momentous. The most important in American history? Maybe. I mean, I think there are a number of contenders. If I think about your period, I think we have to think about 1860.
I really hope it's not if 1860 is our standard about what an important election is.
Indeed. We should probably take a minute and unpack that. My nominees, I guess, would be 1860, 1932, and 1968, maybe for rivals to this one. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think one distinction you have to draw is between those elections that are obviously going to be momentous going into the election. So people a week beforehand know this is going to be an important election, versus maybe elections that we think of are important, but in retrospect. So in retrospect, the 2000 election looks potentially very important in a variety of ways. Going into it, people who were involved in it saw it was important, but it probably wouldn't have ranked particularly high. The big ones for me, I think 1860, which I think we need to unpack, is definitely the most important one. 1932 is critically important in terms of an election where it really led to major changes in policy, and 1968, just because 1968 has got, if you're interested in the history of elections, it's got a bit of everything, much in some ways like this election does.
Well, and to some extent, 1968 set in train the chain of events that brought us to today in terms of some of the issues about race and law and order and the themes. There are themes that directly run from 1968 to today in ways. I mean, those themes exist in those prior elections, but I think there's a real historians 50 years from now might sort of draw a line from, if you're writing the Oxford History of the United States, there might be a volume on 1968 to 2020 or so. So I think 1968 is certainly the immediate predecessor for this one, at least in my own mind. What about 1860, David? That's your field. You can't go on for an hour about it. You have 2 minutes. 1860.
two minutes. Okay. So this is the most important election in American history, I hope, because I hope the one we have about to have doesn't surpass it. Because what happened in 1860 is you end up with this very complicated race between four different candidates, which ends up resulting in Abraham Lincoln's election. Actually, pretty early on the election season, and the election season was very different in the 19th century than it is today. It was pretty clear that the ways in which parties were splitting and merging and emerging in 1860 meant that Lincoln was going to win, and everyone knew this was going to be consequential because it led to directly the secession of South Carolina in December of 1860, that is to say just a month after Lincoln's election, and subsequently other southern states who formed the Confederacy and consequently you have the Civil War. So the Civil War emerges directly in response to half of the country rejecting the election results in 1860 and realizing that, or arguing that, they'd be better off outside of the United States than with Abraham Lincoln as president. That's the super brief version. So I'm really hoping that doesn't happen again, because that didn't was complicated 150 years ago. And I'm not sure we want to go through that again, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we don't. Was there a lot of talk of secession before the election in 1860? In other words, was this something that people, I mean, I know secession had been a theme throughout the 1850s and 60s, but in terms of when people voted in 1860, did they think, oh, if I vote one way or the other, secession could be a consequence of this?
Yes. Well, they did. But on the other hand, you know, the people who were talking about secession, there were especially, you know, a handful of what were called fire eaters, people who were Southern nationalists, who were talking about secession. And they talked about it basically every time they had an opportunity to talk about it. You know, they talked about it in 1850. They talked about it in 1858. They talked about it in 18, you know, so they, it was a running theme for a small or a segment of the Southern populace. And so people knew that was in the, potentially in the offing. What secession meant and whether secession was simply a tactic or something that was actually going to lead to national division and consequentially into civil war. How many people went to the ballot box knowing those things were going to happen, I think is harder to ascertain. It's hard to know what voters think going when they go to vote. But there was definitely people talking about if Lincoln gets elected, then you know, we're out of the Union. But, you know, there's oftentimes before elections where people say, if so-and-so gets elected, I'm moving to Canada. Not many people go move to Canada after every election. So,
well, this one's a really interesting one, because Bruce Springsteen has said he's going to Australia if Trump wins, and Trump says he'll leave the country if Biden wins. So Americans have a choice of which sort of septuagenarian they want to keep in the country, Bruce Springsteen or Donald Trump.
That's what's really on the ballot, Frank, is Bruce Springsteen versus Donald Trump. Okay. You know, I think 1968 is really important also. I think, you know, just in terms of an election where that there were clear alternatives and in which there was a whole lot else going on to make that election weird. Obviously, you had in 1968, you had sort of the civil rights movement still a prominent place in American society. You had the assassination of Martin Luther King. You had the riots, if that's the right word for them, the responses to Martin Luther King's assassination. You had RFK's assassination just a couple months later, who was the leading Democratic candidate, which made the whole election very unusual. In much of the way, I think this election is going to be pretty unusual.
I agree.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm not sure we should spend too much more time on this. I'd rather hear questions from the audience that's given up their time to come and listen. So we're happy to pick up these themes, but let's take some questions.
That's a great idea, Frank.
Yeah, everyone feel free to put questions in the chat there. While we're waiting, I will abuse my sort of power and ask my own question. This week we saw Amy Coney Barrett was sort of confirmed to the Supreme Court and was sworn in. There's always a lot of talk when there's a space for a new justice, especially when that justice is conservative, about pieces of legislation like, or cases rather, like Roe v. Wade and stuff like that. That, you know, but others would say that, well, Roe v. Wade is a precedent now. It's been set and it's been set for long enough. Do you think that there is a risk to progressive pieces of legislation like that being overturned now that there's six conservative justices on the court? And do we have examples in history where the Supreme Court has overturned progressive pieces of sort of legislation and progressive cases?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the short answer, Connell, to my mind is yes. I mean, I think that there's been a kind of conservative project for at least two generations to hack the Supreme Court, and not just the Supreme Court, but also lower courts. And frankly, the right has paid more attention to that in the United States over the past couple of generations than the left has, and that's borne fruit. In terms of the court overturning progressive legislation, I take progressive out of it, just in terms of precedents. Well, Plessy versus Ferguson was a precedent set in 1896 that established separate but equal as a principle, and therefore enshrined segregation and law in the United States. That was overturned in 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education. Now that's not that's regressive legislation being overturned by a progressive decision, but I think it's an interesting analogy because there were 60 years there between those two decisions. And so I think this concept of a precedent or a precedent being longstanding and therefore it can't be changed, I'm not so sure that's true. And if there's one thing we've seen with the kind of conservative movement, if you will, conservative jurisprudential movement in the United States, it's they're willing to overturn precedent. You know, it was a precedent set in 2016 that you couldn't add someone to the Supreme Court during an election year. Well, that precedent was overturned. So I think that they're willing to overturn precedents, either longstanding precedents or short-standing ones. David, what do you have to say?
The big example of the court overturning a progressive legislation is the striking of most of the provisions of the Voting Rights Act.
That's right.
You know, which was a massive piece of legislation passed in 1965 that was critically important for African Americans and other minorities and really almost everybody to get access to the ballot. And the court threw it out a few years ago, saying it was they thought it was no longer relevant legislation, which is a very odd sort of judicial position to take. And they had some slightly more complicated rhetoric sort of attached to that. But, you know, that's the kind of legislation that conservative justices want to get rid of. They see as you know, so... Roe versus Wade is, you know, abortion rights is seriously under jeopardy. The Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, which has been in the courts basically since the day it was passed and probably even before it was passed, you know, is going to be up for review again just in a couple of weeks. And I think that the court has become politicized in a, you know, the court has always been politicized. The court has always been political, but it's always sort of maintained this facade to various degrees of being apolitical. I think right now it's very hard to make those kinds of claims with a straight face.
Well, the really interesting question to my mind, and this depends on what happens with the Senate next week, is how John Roberts will respond and what direction he'll want to see the court go. He's only got a certain amount of control over that as the Chief Justice. But the I think the Democratic desire to reform the courts and particularly reform the court by adding seats to the court is pretty powerful and will be even more so if the court takes some of the decisions that David was talking about, not least because they're pretty unpopular with the bulk of the American people. And I think Roberts might be a check on some of that because he's an institutionalist and he wants to preserve the court as it is. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think the direction of the court in the next few months and years will be very interesting, particularly if it's at odds with the direction of the country electorally.
Great, yeah, thank you. I've got a question from Lucy now, and she asks, if Trump loses, do you think that the Republican Party will make an effort to completely redo its image, given that the party is currently the party of Trump? Or will it continue to try and work with Trump's messages rather than moving on?
That's a really good question. Thank you, Lucy. I think that's a very interesting question. The Republicans had a postmortem after the 2012 election when they actually decided to kind of have a complete rethink. And they said, look, given the demographic trends of the country, we need to reach out, especially to non-white voters. And nothing came of that. And of course, they lost the 2012 election. And then in 2016, Donald Trump's message was very much about going in the opposite direction. But in a country that's becoming increasingly diverse and within a couple of decades, certainly within the lifetimes of most of you who are here listening, the United States, you know, whites will become the largest minority in the United States. Demographically, I think the Republicans win or lose will have to have this kind of rethink if they want to remain electorally viable in the long run. What about you, David?
Yeah, no, I think it depends on how badly he loses, right? And what the loss looks like and how the loss is read. I think the Republican Party right now is the party of Trump, and if Trumpism is rejected, overwhelmingly on Election Day or after Election Day, whenever we know what the results are. The Republican Party is going to have to think very hard about that. And when parties lose badly, they really do a major rethink about what the party stands for. And we can look at examples of 1964 when the Republicans lost badly. We can think about 1984 when the Republican or when the Democrats lost badly, you know, where they really do sort of try to think about what are the major principles the party stands for. It's not out of the question, of course, that that parties, the existing parties, somehow split or change in some kind of profound ways in a very short amount of time. There's lots of examples of both, you know, these parties changing platforms, changing ideas. The Republican Party of today, the Democratic Party of today look very different than these parties did 50 years ago, look extraordinarily different than they did 100 years ago, and massively different than they did 150 years ago. So, you know, the parties are going to be different parties afterwards, depending on what the results are.
Well, in 2016, even, I mean, the Democrats have shifted to the left considerably since 2016 in response to that defeat and the kind of postmortem that they went through after that. So it happens even in near time.
To be sure.
Excellent. Thank you. So I've got a question from Sarah. She asks, do you think we should stay up all night and wait for the results? Or do you think the results will be too close to call on the night? And do you think postal voting will impact when the outcome is announced?
So that's a number of questions. the answer, yes, you should stay up all night because you're going to stay up all night anyway. And David and I were talking about this earlier.
Yeah, I'm going to stay up all night.
We're going to stay up all night. But I sincerely doubt we're going to have a clear outcome on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. I think it's going to take a while, and in part for the reasons that Sarah was talking about. I think postal voting will be an issue. Some states, this is where it's confusing, because in the United States, it's basically 51 concurrent elections going on at the same time. Some states count postal ballots in advance. Some are not allowed to by law. And so Florida, for example, counts them in advance. So we may have a clear idea of where things look in Florida relatively early in the election, you know, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. But we won't know about other states. Pennsylvania and Michigan, which are two key swing states, are not allowed by law to start counting the postal votes until election day. So they may take quite a while, and both of those states were quite important in 2016. So it's likely, I think it's worth staying up because it's gonna be a historic night one way or the other, but I don't think it will be conclusive. I don't think we'll know by Wednesday morning, clearly. I think we may have a clear indication. The other thing to bear in mind is, things are going to change overnight as well. So, for example, the early voting in Florida may well look good for Joe Biden if, as the trends seem to suggest, that most of the majority of postal votes are coming from Democrats. That's not entirely true, but that may look good for Joe Biden. And then the lead will narrow over the course of the evening because Republicans seem to be more willing to vote in person. And certainly that seems to be the suggested case of what we're going to see in Florida. So we're not going to know. It used to be, I mean, back when you guys were kids, didn't pay attention to this kind of stuff, you knew within about an hour of the polls closing. I mean, they would project it in 2008 or 12, and you kind of knew, and that was that. It was prolonged in 2016, and it's going to be even more prolonged, I think.
No, Frank, it was prolonged in 2000.
Yeah, but 2000 was an outlier.
Yeah, because I remember that night I was, you know, planning. I'd say I'll stay up until I hear a concession speech, and it turns out I stayed up a lot longer that night than I was intending to, because there was no concession speech for days and weeks and months, or at least weeks. You know, there was a long period of time in which Americans were sort of, you know, lulled into the sense that they would know by, you know, midnight Eastern time what the election results were going to be. There were a number of elections in which, you know, pollsters got the exit polls right enough where they knew who the next president was going to be. And there was a concession speech and there was an acceptance speech. And, you know, you got to bed late, but not super late. I think this time it's going to maybe be, you know, a couple, at least the next day and maybe a couple of days until we know the results.
I think we won't know till the weekend for sure.
It depends on how close it is, right? And there's a couple of key states and we could know, you know, one thing I think, we learned from 4 years ago is that, you know, our expectations about what things are going to look like may be totally off. You know, we both went into 4 years ago thinking odds are Hillary Clinton was going to win it, and we would, you know, recognize that by you know, 1 or 2 in the morning Eastern time. And we were clearly, obviously wrong about that. So give our prognostications with some, a grain of salt or two.
Yeah. Our abilities as prognosticators are pretty consistently called into question.
Yeah. We're good at the past mostly, but the future, not so much.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. I've got a question from Scarlett. She asks, to go on Connell's question about the Supreme Court nominations, why do you think that there was such discrepancies and differences from the Republican Party between this Supreme Court nominee versus Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland?
Scarlett, it's about power. They had power and they used the power they had. And I think they Mitch McConnell, the leader, the Republican leader of the Senate, can read the polls like we can. I think he has a reasonable fear that they will lose control of the Senate next week. And so he wanted to get this seat through. And it was charges of hypocrisy bounced off him like, I don't know, bullets off Superman. He doesn't care. And so it was about they used power while they had the power. And it's, to my mind, it's that simple.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the United States is ruled by laws, but also by sort of norms and precedent. And I think one of the things that's happened in the past 4 years is lots of the norms and precedents have kind of gone out the window. So there has been a lot of sort of power politics, taking opportunities when they're available and using that power to advance whatever political aims that is, whether that's blocking somebody's appointment or appointing somebody else that you do like. So,
great, thank you. I've got a question from Jessica, and this is kind of the golden question, if you like. She says, simple question for you both. Who do you think will win? Has Trump done enough to make America great again to be reelected?
Again, that's actually two questions.
Frank, so we do that all the time.
Yes. It's more of a comment than a question. Look, the odds favor Joe Biden, and they favor Joe Biden even more heavily than they did Hillary Clinton at this point 4 years ago. Having said that, I mean, by most of the, I don't know what model you look at, but if you look at, I don't know, Nate Silver's or The Economist, they're giving Trump anywhere from about 10 to 15% chance of winning. I think that's about right. Having said that, he could win. That, you know, if they ran the election 100 times, he would win, say, 15 of them. So this could be one of those times. I think Joe Biden will win. And I think that there are sort of underlying things that make the, a lot of people are making comparisons between now and 2016 for obvious reasons and saying 4 years ago, David and Frank, you said the same thing then. The odds looked similar. Well, that's true. I think there are a couple of differences. First of all, we have 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency. So Donald Trump is not sort of promising change. We know what voters know what they're getting with Donald Trump when they're making that decision. So it's a more informed electorate. Secondly, I don't think Joe Biden is as controversial a figure in certain quarters of the American electorate for all kinds of reasons, gender being one of them, as Hillary Clinton was. It's hard to scare people with Joe Biden. And, you know, so Trump has a challenge there. Third, the polls and the polls have held up not just nationally, but also in the key swing states. The swing state polls were going against Hillary Clinton at this point 4 years ago. That is not apparently what's happened with Joe Biden. So I think those things all augur well for Joe Biden. Having said that, there's a pandemic going on. We don't know what's going to happen with all the postal votes. And the Supreme Court, of course, has a 6-3 conservative majority and may be called upon to adjudicate disputes over the votes. And if it's very close, who knows what will happen? Sorry, David, I probably said.
And we've got 5 days or 5 full days left, 6 days left. In 2020 time, that's, you know, like a year and a half. So there's all kinds of things that could happen between now and election day. Granted, one of the things that makes this election unusual is how many people are voting early, which changes, you know, exit polling and how accurate that is. Polling itself has gotten harder to do with every passing year because, you know, when polling started and the pollster called you, almost everybody took the call and answered the poll. You know, back in the 1950s when Gallup was doing all of its polling, and that was sort of the, you know, being called by a pollster was something people were happy to respond to. Now, most people either don't answer the phone because people don't answer their phones anymore, or they hang up on the pollster. And so, you know, getting accurate polls is even if the science of polling is much more advanced, the getting good numbers is very hard. So
70 million people have already voted. So the likelihood of an event in the next few days changing the outcome of the election diminishes because of that.
Voter turnout looks like it's going to be very, very high, at least by American standards. So it's good. It's going to be very, it's going to be unusual in all kinds of ways.
Great. Thank you. So this is from Carice, I think. There's been a lot of talk and analysis about the effect of certain key swing states on the outcome of the election. Has this always been the case in US presidential elections, or is it a more recent phenomenon?
It's always been the case. It's just the swing states change depending on the circumstances. David, I've been going first too often. You should take this.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You are the senior partner of the team. So I think the structure of the Electoral College and the way in which votes get distributed, you know, means that there's always going to be only a handful of states really in play, except in a landslide. So, in the past 25 years, Florida has been one of those places. Actually, Florida has often been a swing state, but Ohio has often been a swing state, and there tends to be a few, at least in recent history, that have been perennial swing states. But if you went back a century or a century and a half, you have different states that are swing states. But I think it's sort of the structure of the system does lend itself to the candidates focusing on, just a handful of places over the rest of the country.
One thing to look for on next Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, is if the commentators are talking about Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio as swing states, it's probably looking good for Donald Trump, or at least it's going to be a close election. If the swing states they're talking about are Georgia and Arizona or even Texas, then it's probably a good night for Joe Biden. So the swing states may well change, Harris, even in the context of what this election and what we expect to happen, depending on how the vote plays out. But there have always been swing states.
In this case, there are even a couple of swing districts. There are two states which distribute their electoral votes, not winner take all the way most states do, but by congressional district, and that's Maine and Nebraska. And I think Trump was campaigning in Nebraska yesterday, in part because there's one district around Omaha that is a swing district. So he's campaigning for one electoral vote. So that, I think, speaks to how close that he thinks it's going to be.
Excellent. Thank you. So we've got Sarah. She says, kind of building on Lucy's questions, we are seeing a few Republican senators, such as Ben Sasse, I think, having condemned Trump. Having condemned Trump. How do you think Republicans will view the Trump era historically in the future? Do you think more people will condemn him if he loses badly? Also, are people condemning him now? Haven't they always known what kind of a person Trump was?
Some people have condemned him throughout. I think if he loses, particularly if he loses badly next Tuesday, you will see them all condemning him ex post facto and telling us how they fought against Trump and Trumpism behind the scenes. And you couldn't, I think we'll have a lot of rats leaving the sinking ship under those circumstances. If he wins and retains his hold on the Republican Party, I think the only people left in the Republican Party will be Trumpists, because a lot of moderate Republicans and a lot of anti-Trump Republicans, and we've seen this with the Lincoln Project, for example, have either left the party in all but name, like the Lincoln Project, or they've become Democrats. So I think there will be a realignment. But I think if Trump loses, I think you'll quickly see the Republican Party or some Republicans try to rewrite the history of this period and say, yeah, it wasn't us. We, nothing to do with us.
I think Trump has been a galvanizing figure really from the moment he entered the campaign. Nobody is really sort of neutral on him. And, in that respect, he reminds me of Andrew Jackson, as somebody who people either passionately loved and thought he was the greatest thing to ever enter the White House, or the worst, corruption of the office they'd ever seen. And Trump may have a similar kind of legacy that Jackson has had, whereas, even though Jackson's been dead for 165 years, people are not neutral on him. whether people love him or hate him, he tends to be a sort of galvanizing figure. And I think people who are true believers, I think some of them, as Frank pointed out, may abandon ship, but I think some of them are going to go down believing this was the best 4 years the United States has ever had.
David, do you think that, do you see revisionist historians 20 years from now saying, oh, actually, Trump got a lot of things right and we misunderstood it at the time?
Well, historians are always right about two periods. They're always writing about the time they're writing about, and they're trying to write about their own time. So I think what historians say in 20 years will entirely depend on what 20 years from now looks like. I think they'll be responding to the pressures and the issues that are relevant 20 years from now, and who knows what those will be. But, there are lots of presidents who do get reconsidered significantly after they leave office. I mean, Carter is a great example. Carter, when he left office, was very unpopular, and historians since then have rehabilitated him and his presidency in all kinds of ways. Same was true of Truman. Same was true of Grant, who at one point was ranked as one of the worst presidents, and now is, they do these presidential rankings, which is kind of stupid. But now he's often somewhere in the middle, if not in the top third. Historians can reevaluate things, and whatever values future historians have may be different than, and perspectives and knowledge will be different than the ones we have. So,
of course, I mean, one thing to say is next Tuesday might have a lot to do with what the world looks like 20 years from now. Secondly, Carter's rehabilitation, of course, had a lot to do with his post-presidency, which is still going on because he's still alive in his mid-90s, but he's been very active and seen as a kind of a figure of great moral authority and consequence, kind of globally, his actions, his activities with regard to election monitoring, for example, and around the world are part of that. It's hard to see President Trump having a significant, certainly a lengthy post-presidency and a post-presidency that's uncontroversial.
But Frank, he's got the best genes.
He does. He's going to live forever.
Great. Thank you both. We've got a question from Marco, and he asks, with the election a week away, what do leaders around the world want to see happen? Has Trump's asymmetrical and chaotic foreign policy tainted American reputation on the long term, or is the damage fixable under Biden?
I think everything's fixable. I mean, I think the prestige of the United States on a global scale has been damaged significantly over the past 4 years, at least from my perspective. But I mean, I think, we had the same thing happen under George W. Bush and it improved under Obama. So I think people will, depending on the direction of the new administration, if there is a new administration, things can change.
I mean, in terms of Marco's question, it really depends on which world leader you're talking about. Some of them are perfectly happy to see Trump continue. Others,
exactly.
Not so much. I would imagine most of the NATO leaders would like to see a change. I think David's point is a good one. I'm actually slightly more optimistic than many of the people I speak to about on this particular question. And I think back to 2008-09, I mean, for goodness sake, they gave President Obama the Nobel Peace Prize essentially for not being George W. Bush when he was, because he hadn't served as president when they gave it to him in 2009. He'd just been elected. And so I think that there's a desire. We've had 4 years of rather chaotic American leadership when it comes to international relations, regardless of your views on President Trump, but the kind of inconsistency has been very difficult. And regardless of what you think of the United States as a hegemonic power, its role undergirding global security has been pretty profound until the past 4 years. And the absence of that has been very destabilizing. So even some of America's adversaries, I think, for example, in Beijing, they may welcome Joe Biden thinking, okay, America's still an adversary of ours, but at least it'll be more predictable. So I think that America's destabilizing role in the past 4 years is such that there'll be a global desire to go back to the way things were as quickly as possible, even if we can't really go back to the way things were. And so that the recovery, especially of Joe Biden, I think he's well qualified to do this because he knows a lot of world leaders, given his tenure as vice president. he's going to have to go on an apology tour. It's going to be pretty, you know, he's going to have to eat a lot of crow in the first few months of office. But I think he'll do that, and he'll do it in a way he's a very genial person. I think it works well domestically. I think it'll work well internationally. And I think there'll be a desire to restore the status quo as much as possible pretty quickly, especially if he shows a little bit of humility, because humility is not one of the qualities that one associates with Donald Trump and his foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's happened over the past 4 years, and one thing I'm worried about is the number of people who worked in government service and in the State Department in particular, who have left under the Trump administration. People who, you know, are sort of apolitical people who have served under a number of administrations, who have decided they can't perform that function any longer. And I'm wondering whether these people will come back if Biden wins. Because there's been a really hollowing out of expertise in a variety of fields, and rebuilding that will take time.
It will, but it's also an opportunity. You know, if they don't come back, do you know what? There'll be thousands and thousands of young people like the people on this call who can fill those jobs, and maybe we need a refreshing of all these agencies anyway. You got to see it as an opportunity, David.
Opportunity. Careers for future Edinburgh graduates.
Many years ago, I took a university leadership course. I was compelled to do this because I'm getting old, and so they wanted me to become a leader. And I was told you shouldn't talk about problems, you should talk about opportunities. So this isn't a problem, David, it's an opportunity. You need to take a university management course, leadership course.
And so I can learn how to speak leadership speak, okay.
Exactly, so okay. These are opportunities, David.
Okay, we have lots of opportunities, Frank. Good.
Thank you. I've got a question from Aaron. There's a lot of talk about Trump refusing to leave office if he loses / trying to call the election early. How possible is this?
I think he may well try to call the election early because if the early voting favors him, he'll try to declare himself the winner. I think that's one of the challenges we face next week, because I think it's going to take a few days for the results to come in, especially in some key states. If it's close, if it's a landslide for Biden, I think a landslide for Biden is possible. I don't think a landslide for Trump is possible. So if it's a landslide for Biden, I don't think he'll be able to do that. The question of what happens if he doesn't leave office, and I think David and I will be doing episodes about this during the interregnum. I think the thing that really does worry me is what happens, and where I do think will be an unprecedented, uncharted territory is that period between November 4th, 5th, 6th, whenever we know the outcome, if Trump loses, and January 20th, when Biden is inaugurated, if that's how it plays out, because I think the potential for chaos during that period and possibly unrest is pretty significant. David, what do you think?
I think that's one of the ways in which American politics is different from British politics, whereas British politics, you have an election the next day, you know, people take office. At least that's my understanding as somebody who is probably the least informed person about British politics in this call. You know, whereas in the United States, we have this very lengthy period between when the election happens and when the people take office. And it used to be much lengthier. You know, before the 1930s, the gap was until March. And so you'd have, you know, 4 months of the old administration still being in power, which can, lots can happen in 4 months. And now it's, you know, 2 months, so it's a little bit less, but it's a, you know, it's going to be a very interesting period if Biden wins, what Trump does and what the Republicans in Congress do during that window.
That's where the Supreme Court and the Senate and the what used to be called the Republican establishment will be really important, because they will need, if that scenario plays out whereby Trump loses, it's relatively close, they need to stand up and say, look, you've got to play by the rules. Whether they will do that, we've had no evidence of that thus far. The length of the period, David, interests me because it was shortened, of course, in the 1930s, it was shortened during the Depression. So the reason for this long period between the election in November and when the inauguration used to take place in March was because it took so long to count the votes when people traveled by horse. And it just took, everything was slower then, right? And then during the Depression, they shortened it because of the Depression. They recognized that having this lengthy period just was too long. I'm wondering now, David, one of my thoughts about the current election is, if the period between the election and the inauguration of Joe Biden, if Biden wins, is as chaotic as it could be, if there'll be a impulse to try and shorten that in the future. Because, of course, because of technology, we now know, and they could theoretically start on January 1st instead of January 20th, or even at the end of December. I wonder if they'll shorten that period yet again.
I think that's a distinct possibility. Because, I mean, you know, even in the 19th century, when people were traveling by horseback or what have you, lots can happen in that window. You know, thinking about election of 1860, between the time when Lincoln is elected and when he takes office, a whole bunch of things happen. South Carolina leaves the Union, followed by a bunch of other states in the South. They have time to establish the Confederate States of America. They have time to have a provisional government established and have their own president inaugurated, Jefferson Davis, the best and only president of the Confederacy. Lots can happen in that window. The same happened in 1932, whenever FDR was raring to go and ready to go, but he had to wait a very long time at the height of the Great Depression before he took office, before his administration could start to implement the New Deal. And a lot of people suffered during that window, when the Hoover administration was still in power and was not taking as robust action as FDR was intending to take. So I think, you know, that changing that date, I think, makes a lot of sense. It would require a constitutional amendment, which is not easy. So,
great, thank you. We've got a question from Daisy now. She says, do you think that social media will have a significant role in influencing the results of this election as it did in the 2016 one?
The answer is yes. I suspect it won't have the same role, though. And if you think about the attempts over the past few weeks to gin up a kind of controversy around Hunter Biden and Hunter Biden's activities and email and so on and so forth, that hasn't kind of taken root in the same way that the controversies over Hillary Clinton's email server did 4 years ago. Now, in part, I think that's because, and I alluded to this earlier, Hillary Clinton was scarier to people who hated Hillary Clinton in a way that Joe Biden is not and Joe Biden's son is not. But secondly, I think the media is savvier than it was 4 years ago about this. And I think the public is savvier in terms of how they consume social media. Having said that, social media is immensely important in terms of the way people get information and so on. And it would be naive to assume that people seeking to influence the outcome of the election, either political actors in the United States or some of the adversaries of the United States or even allies of the United States in seeking to influence the outcome of the election. What do you think, David?
Oh, I think you're 100% right. It's going to be a huge impact. You know, the ability of whether it's candidates or parties or other interested individuals or groups to target specific voters and target specific messages using social media is really quite profound and has really changed the way in which campaigns work. That you can say something very, very different to, you know, one person and say a very different thing to their neighbor, depending on the ways in which you can sort of micro-target them. And micro-target them not only with information, but with misinformation is quite profound. So
let's imagine a scenario where we don't have the outcome. It's close. And we don't have the votes. We don't have the outcome from Pennsylvania for several days. But Trump is ahead in Pennsylvania on the voting on the day because Republicans are voting in person, whereas Democrats are voting by ballot, postal ballot rather. And it takes several days to get that result. That result could be absolutely okay, right? But in that intervening 2 or 3 or 4 days, you could see a social media campaign to invalidate those postal votes as they're being counted, or to allege that it's the fix is in or so on. And then that causes a problem as to whether those votes are seen as legitimate, et cetera. So I think social media has plays a role in campaigning, but I think it could really play a role if we have an electoral crisis in the next couple of weeks.
Now, I believe, I might be wrong about this, but my understanding is Facebook has actually banned ads after Election Day that are political ads. But that doesn't stop the kind of organic or semi-organic or astroturfed, I want to say viral, but that's probably not the right word to say in 2020. sui generis kind of sharing of misinformation that may happen in social media in the post election window. So it's going to be messy, I think, and it's going to be messy in complicated ways, and messy in probably ways we won't understand for years to come. I'm still trying to make sense of 2016, and that, you know, we've had some time to think about that.
Thank you. A question from James. He asks, what would it mean for US democracy if a president was to serve two terms in office without winning the popular vote in either election?
It wouldn't be good. I mean, it can happen. That's the nature of the Electoral College. I mean, it can happen, especially in close elections. But if I think James asked a good question, because I think that's probably the only scenario by which President Trump gets reelected. I think it's an incredibly close election. Let's assume all the votes are okay. It's an incredibly close election, but he wins in the right places as he did last time. I think it's unlikely, but I think that's the scenario that would probably return him to office. If that happens, that would mean it happened in 2020, 2016, and 2000. That would not, you know, that's an interesting, this used to be something that happened once a century. If it happens three times in 20 years, that would suggest a problem.
Well, it tends to happen in particular windows, because, you know, it happened a few times in the late 19th century. Where you end up with a handful of, that's why you end up with Grover Cleveland with two non-consecutive terms, you know, where the person who wins the popular vote doesn't win the Electoral College. I think what's really interesting about this moment and what's going to happen on Tuesday is about how big the victory is in the popular vote and how that almost doesn't matter at all. I mean, Hillary Clinton won by 3 million votes, if memory serves. You know, and Joe Biden could win by 4 million votes. It doesn't, you know, ultimately those votes don't matter, because what matters is the Electoral College. But, you know, the more this happens, the less legitimate the entire system looks as a authentic democracy, both within the United States and around the world.
Thank you. I've got another question from Scarlett, and this kind of calls back to last week's episode. How do you think the outcome will be affected by third parties, i.e. Kanye West this time?
Birthday party. Our last episode was about third parties, where we talked about the role that those have had. And obviously there have been some elections where the third party had a pivotal role and really changed the outcome. We can think about 1912. We can think about 1992. We can think of several other examples in which third parties really factored fairly heavily into the outcome. One of the things we sort of realized in our last episode was third parties seem to matter most when the two parties aren't clear alternatives to each other. And I think in this election, the two parties, or at least the two candidates at the top of the parties, present very clear alternatives. And so people are often looking for a third party when they're dissatisfied with their options. Frank, what do you think?
Yeah, there are third party candidates on the ballots in all the states, and we talked about that last week, but I don't think it's going to be a very significant factor. I think that the stakes are so clear to people that I think they're it really is being seen as a Trump versus Biden choice. So I don't think they'll factor, but the usual warnings apply that David and I are terrible when we prognosticate. So, well, Kanye West will probably win Florida now.
Well, but you know, one could imagine a scenario in which, like in Florida in 2000, where the difference between the two candidates, you know, is in the hundreds, or in Pennsylvania or in a number of other states, in which case the third party theoretically, you know, is the number of people who vote for Kanye in Florida maybe more than the difference between Trump and Biden.
Sure, but the one thing about 2000 was that was a time when people believed there was no difference between the two parties and it wasn't a big choice. And so Ralph Nader had there was a bigger movement for Nader in 2000 on the grounds that there was no difference between Bush and Gore. Nobody's saying there's no difference between Biden and Trump this time.
100%.
You're right. It could come down to a few hundred votes, but I doubt it. It won't, because Kanye is going to win Florida. I'm predicting that right now.
Oh, boy.
Thank you. So this question is from Craig. He says, is the silent Trump vote real? And if so, is it a factor in the election at all?
I don't think so. If we've learned one thing in the past 4 years, it's that Trump supporters aren't very silent. They, you know, I think Trump supporters really, really, really support Donald Trump. And I think they're not ashamed to say so. So I don't think there's a kind of silent Trump vote, but David might have a different view.
Well, I mean, so the idea of a silent vote, of course, goes back to sort of Richard Nixon and him talking about a silent majority of voters who were, you know, not activists, who were not in the streets. And of course, this is at the height of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, in which you saw protesters in the streets. And Nixon was saying, well, look, there are these segments of the people who are, you know, decent and law abiding and what have you, and support me, even if they don't do so loudly. I think Frank is right that there are a lot of Trump supporters who are obviously very proud of being Trump supporters. But I also think there is a segment of people who right now are embarrassed by Trump and are voting for him with their holding their nose. You know, there, for instance, there are people who are evangelical Christians who are some of Trump's major supporters. I think there's a segment of evangelical Christians who look in Trump and say, everything about this man I hate, except for the fact that he might be the vehicle through which abortion is taken off the table. And so I'm going to vote for him. And, you know, there, I think there may not be articulate about it or loud about it, but there might be a segment of the population. Whether that's as big a segment of the population as it was 4 years ago, we'll find out on Tuesday or Wednesday.
And I don't think they were ever going to vote for Biden.
No, even though many of them are Catholic and Biden is a devout Catholic and practicing, and Trump is whatever Trump is.
Excellent, thank you. This question from Sammy. Currently it's neck and neck in the Texas polls. Is this a problem for the GOP going into the future if Texas is potentially shifting left?
Well, Texas is a state that's having really massive demographic shifts. And I think part of the reason why Texas is becoming a purple state, if from a very deep red state, if we're going to use the traditional or the semi-traditional colors. You know, and I think the likelihood is that Texas is going to continue in that demographic trend. I mean, when we think about blue states and red states, oftentimes actually the distinction is between blue cities and red rural areas. And in fact, in most states, you've got a red area that's rural and a blue pockets that are urban. You know, the maps that Trump always likes to show where he shows about which counties he won, and the map looks almost all red until you realize those are counties with no people in it. Texas is becoming, like most of the rest of the country, more urban and therefore potentially more blue. So I think, you know, if Texas becomes a swing state, that has real problems for at least the current version of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say two things with regard to that. Yes, I think that's absolutely true. If Texas were to go Democratic, then you will find that Republicans are no longer quite as attached to the Electoral College as they have been in the recent past, because it will be almost impossible for them to win. If Democrats can start with New York, California, and Texas, it's almost impossible for the Republicans to win. Having said that, I would say two things. One is, this prediction about Texas going Democratic has been going on almost for as long as Texas, since Texas went Republican about 40, 45 years ago. And it never hasn't quite happened yet. We've had a number of close calls. And this reminds me of some of the predictions about the 2016 election. The polls look good, I will say that, for Joe Biden and some and the Democrats in Texas. But I'll believe it when I see it in terms of this year. The second thing I would say is the Electoral College map, you know, this goes back to the earlier question about swing states. The swing states change. The country is changing. So, you know, if Texas were to go Democratic and, you know, return, it was Democratic for a century, if it were to become Democratic again, that's not to say the rest of the country will continue to look the way it does. So the map may well change just as Texas changes in ways that we can't anticipate.
Great, thank you. And I think probably our last question, it's quite a long one, and it is from Helena. So she says, we are absolutely sure as we enter a new decade, we are met with unprecedented times and change in political circumstances. Apart from the result of next week's election, is there any chance for American society to witness social transformation resulting in the Democratic Party becoming more leftist? What are what are the extraordinary moments in US history where American political life reacted to such shocks? And obviously how the political life reacted to them.
To answer the first part of the question, and I'll throw over to David to think about previous periods, I think we're actually in the midst of one of those moments, Elena. I think one way to interpret the Trump period and the Trump election of 2016 was as a counter-revolutionary moment because of what has happened since 2008. So I think we're in a moment of profound social change as a result of a number of things, chiefly demography, but not only. And that social change has resulted in real improvements in certain aspects of American life. The Affordable Care Act is really, really important in this regard. And I think we could be on the cusp of greater social change. And what we've seen is a counter-revolutionary backlash against that, but we may be in the midst of a period of change as we speak because of, I'm looking at a lot of young people on the screen because of young people in particular, but I think we are on the cusp of change. I'm actually quite optimistic about that. David, have we ever seen this in the past?
Well, I mean, I think social change and political change tends to be, episodic, to sort of draw biological metaphor, there's kind of a punctuated equilibrium with political change. Things tend to stay the same until particular moments in which they change quite rapidly and oftentimes in ways that we don't expect. If you said in the early 1950s that, a decade later that you would have, integration and you would have, these fuller voting rights for African Americans, I think most people would have thought that was crazy. I think there's a likelihood, there's always a likelihood that things could change very quickly in ways that people don't expect. If we can think about the recent past, that the fight for marriage equality, was not going anywhere until it advanced very quickly in a very short number of years after a long period of being opposed and in fact repressed by people who opposed it. And now support for marriage equality is pretty widespread in the United States. And that happened within the past 20 years. And so I think there's a potential for some real radical change, although there's also a potential for a lot of disappointment if that's what you're hoping for.
Don't disillusion the kids, David.
I'm trying to give them realistic expectations, Frank, about their opportunities.
He's Eeyore on this podcast. He's so negative.
I'm not negative. Maybe I am. I said 4 years ago, Frank, that I was worried about the fate of the Republic, and I think the past 4 years have partially borne out my fears. So, Maybe my pessimism is not entirely without merit. But it's good for you to keep me young and optimistic, Frank. So thank you for that. I want to thank all of you guys for some really excellent questions. I mean, I think your questions really sort of push us to sort of think about things and ask, address important issues. We hope you continue to listen to the podcast. If you want to, you can, hear us answer the questions again, if that's in your interest. So thank you really so much for showing up this evening and talking with us. And so, Frank, until next week.
And cheers,
Connell,
David.
Thank you very much for hosting, by the way. Connell,
yeah, thanks,
job.
Connell.
Excellent job for the History Society for organizing this. Until we next week, Frank, cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.